This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 112. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. How are you doing this week, Rob?
I'm doing good. We had a new addition to the Startups for the Rest of Us drinking game, and it was submitted by Will Samuels, and he said, drink whenever Mike says, essentially. Toast a glass of eggnog and prepare to do some drink in this episode.
Yeah, I've noticed I do that a lot.
What's going on? Did you get anything cool for Christmas?
I got a Kindle Paperwhite.
Very nice. How's the screen? I've heard they're nice, easy to read.
It is very nice. I was actually reading it last night in bed. It was nice. It was not like the iPad where, and part of the reason I wanted it was because it was not an iPad, because the iPad's got that LCD screen and the light is basically shining through it, right into your eye, versus everything I read about the Kindle and the Kindle Paperwhite was that it's more or less backlit where the light shines down on the letters and then reflects off of them as opposed to shining directly from the back. And it was a very nice experience. It's very easy on the eyes. You can read it in low light and you can adjust the lighting levels. It's just a very nice, pleasant reading experience. I feel like it's a lot better to read in bed than an iPad.
That's what I've heard. Makes it easier to go to sleep and doesn't mess with your REM. The Kindle Paperwhite is the next, what is it, like the fourth generation Kindle. It's the same price as the old one, but you can read it in the dark without having an external light on it like the old Kindles.
They still sell the ones that are not backlit, and those are still about $60 or $70. Okay. This one was about $110 or $120. It's kind of in between the like a baseline Kindle, and then you've got the Paperwhite, and then you've got the Kindle Fire, and it's the LCD screen and everything else.
Cool. You have to admit, I have Kindle envy because I have an iPad 1. It weighs, I don't know, a pound and a half or something. And it, you know, if you get in bed, it actually is just hard to hold up. You need two hands. I really have thought about getting a Kindle as well because they're so light.
Yeah, and that's part of why I wanted it. So far, it's working out. Probably give some sort of an update in 3 or 4 months after I've actually used it for more than, what, 2 days?
Sure. Well, hey, I've had more credit card failures than usual. Hittail, normally it charges X people per night for their monthly membership. And there's just been a substantial rise in credit card failures. And you know what I think is going on? I have no way to prove this. But I think that either people's cards are maxed out or the velocity of charges has flagged just a few more of them with the, you know, like the risk department of the credit card has flagged them and kind of shut them down until they can get it cleared. You know, again, can't validate that, but that's the only reason I can think of that, you know, that the charges wouldn't be working all of a sudden. Cause it's not like it's at the beginning of a new month. Oftentimes, you know, I'll see things that expired from 1 month to the next, but it's the middle of December. And I would expect that maybe at the start of next year, but
it could be. I recently got a new American Express card, and it's not like my old one was expiring. I just got a brand new one in the mail. I have no idea why. I think it had to do with they've got some like new chips that they're putting into the cards. So I don't know how many of those cards are American Express versus something else, but that might be what the issue is where people are switching cards. And then because of that, their old cards are being denied because they're no longer valid.
Got it. Yeah, good to know. How about you? Have you been doing any work on AutoChark?
Yeah, I've had a bunch of articles written recently. I think I mentioned last week that I was going to get that started. I tried out a few different things, and I've got about 10 different articles on various topics written at this point. Most of the quality has been pretty good. There's been one that was off topic. We asked for false positives or false negatives, basically a definition of it, and we forgot to specifically state that it related to compliance. So they gave it to us based on email false positives and false negatives. So it was more about spam filtering than about compliance. And we tried going back and forth with them, but it was just going to be a nightmare. So we're just ordering a brand new one. And it was only, I think, $8 or $9 to have it written. So it's more cost effective to have them rewrite it than it is to try and go back and forth with the original author.
We've seen this happen from time to time with the articles that people order through Hittail. And we've actually had to tweak our UI and add an extra required field that forces our Hittail customers to add more detail to article requests, because they'll just say, all right, write an article about these keywords. And oftentimes, you know, it might say going to the Notre Dame. But what they mean is going to Notre Dame, the college in Indiana. You know, I mean, there are these things where people just get it totally wrong. There's the same city names in like Canada and the US and England, and they'll say, you know, blank city name real estate. And so without an extra layer of specification of what you really want the article to be about, you'll often get the incorrect subject matter. So I can totally see how that would happen. You really can't fault them, because when I hear false positives, I would, in technology, I would also think of email false positives.
We caught it before, well, it wasn't before it got to the person, but apparently the writer had picked it up, and we got in touch with the intermediary, I'll call them, and said, hey, should we just want to clarify and add some notes on here, and it looks like we're not going to be able to. And they said, oh yeah, once a writer picks it up, there's nothing we can do. You can't send them additional instructions or change anything, nothing. I'm like, you can't even just forward this information to them, and apparently not. So whatever. What do you do?
Sure. I did want to cover some iTunes reviews we've gotten recently. I want to thank Kyle MB, who said, real value, no fluff. I've listened to you guys for about 12 months. Rob and Mike share real-life practical information that provides value. And Scott Bartell said, great podcast. Awesome thought-provoking content offering some great advice that is typically actionable and applicable to my startup. So I encourage you, if you haven't gone into iTunes, even if you don't write a full review like that, you can just click the 5-star rating, and you don't have to do anything else. And we really appreciate it. It helps us rank well in iTunes, helps us grow our audience. And we obviously, you know, appreciate you taking the time to do that.
You know, I reviewed a very interesting book over the past couple of weeks for O'Reilly. They got in touch and asked if I'd be interested in taking a look at this book. It's called Lean Analytics for Startups. And it's all about looking at data, trying to figure out what it is that you should be doing, talking to people, and trying to figure out what it is that they actually mean versus what they are telling you, and being able to read between the lines. And then some of it's, I'll say, softer skills, because you're interpreting what people are telling you, versus a lot of it is very hardcore math about, these are some numbers that you should be looking at, and this is exactly how you should track them and how you should follow them. And it doesn't give you technology specific things in terms of what of how you should track them, just these are the data points that you need, and these are the actions that people need to undertake in order for you to track that information.
Nice. Did you take away anything that you think you'll be putting into place with your businesses?
I did. I took a bunch of notes, and obviously, as part of the review process, I had to send them back a filled out questionnaire that had, it was probably 2 or 3 pages worth of questions that they had. But then in addition to that, I sent them probably 8 or 10 pages worth of supplemental notes and stuff on different things that were in the book, things that I thought either they need to be elaborated on, or it just didn't make much sense in the context of where they stood in the book. But there was a lot of really good information in there. So yeah, I definitely took some notes and made sure that I'll be integrating some of that. But the one interesting thing that I found was that it almost seemed like no matter what the stage of your business, the book was going to be applicable to you, or at least certain parts of it. When you start your business, there are certain things that are going to be applicable to you. And then as you progress into your business and you start building it up, there are other parts of the books that are applicable to you. So depending on what stage you're in, it's going to have something for you. It just depends on, you know, where you're at with your business.
That sounds good. I'll have to check it out when it comes out. I just listened to episode 219 of TechZing, and it's called Confessions of an Overcommitter. And Justin and Jason talk about overcommitting to doing too many projects and just their process, some projects they've had to abandon over the past couple of years. It's really quite interesting. I'd recommend, you know, even if folks don't typically, even if you don't typically make it through the 90-minute TechZing podcast every week, it's an exceptional episode that I wanted to call out because I resonated a lot. And I feel like the entrepreneurial ADD that a lot of people have will, you know, you'll resonate with this episode. So check it out if you have time over the holiday break.
Speaking of those guys, are you taking funding from Jason?
No, I'm not. Did you hear that episode?
Yeah, oh, he's talked about it several times. He's like, yeah. Oh, I'd love to just dump money into whatever Rob's doing.
Yeah, no, I don't think I'm going to take funding. Obviously, I told him, you know, you'll be first on the list if I decide to, but it's more trouble than it's worth to take a little bit of funding just with the structuring that needs to take place and all that. I don't really need the funding. At this point, I have enough in the bank to fund this as fast as I can. And I guess if I wanted to get, you know, drip specifically, if I wanted to grow quicker, I would consider funding, obviously, if it was the right choice. But I just don't think without raising several hundred grand, it's kind of not worth the effort to do so.
Cool. So I think in today's episode, we're going to be talking about startup metrics for pirates. There's an acronym that Dave McClure came up with. And Dave McClure, if you're not familiar with who he is, he's an entrepreneur and a prominent angel investor who's based in San Francisco. And he founded and runs a business incubator named 500 Startups. And he does public speaking engagements and works with a lot of different startups. And the acronym that he came up with is, it's called Startup Metrics for Pirates because it's AARRR. Kind of a play on R for pirates.
Yeah, if folks haven't heard of Dave McClure, he's more than just an angel investor. He founded a technology consulting company in 94, and then he worked as a consultant for Microsoft, Intel, and other companies. He was the director of marketing at PayPal for some key years, 2001 to 2004. Then he launched and he ran marketing for Simply Hired, which a lot of you probably heard of. And he was also heavily involved in Mint.com. I think he chose to hire Noah Kagan to run the marketing. So I think he was the marketing guy there before Noah. So he definitely has experience, you know, with this kind of stuff. And then as Mike said, he started his seed accelerator in 2010 and has been doing, he's been an outspoken, you know, large personality angel investor. So people either love him or hate him in general.
So the acronym that he came up with is there's two A's and three R's. And the first A is acquisition. Second A is activation. The first R is retention. The second R is referral. And the third R is revenue. And we're going to talk through these five different things. There's two different things that Dave points out about these. And the first one is that these are explicitly for marketing. These things that you do apply specifically to the marketing, not necessarily to the product itself, because there are different things that you are going to do with the product versus the marketing behind it. The second thing is that these are not exactly sequential. And one of the things that he would do is he would put an emphasis on activation and retention before acquisition and referral, because you want to make sure that people are actually using your product and you are retaining them as users before you go out and try to do a lot of acquisition and referral to try and scale things up. And there are certain things that are more important, but it's definitely important to that you make an attempt to go through these different stages in your startup and try to apply them to the marketing plans that you put in place.
I see. So when he says they're not sequential, and again, let's run through the five. It's acquisition, activation, retention, referral, and revenue. So they're not sequential in terms of what your business should focus on and optimize. But for the most part, they would be sequential for a single customer coming through your business, because first you would acquire them through, you know, general means. We'll be talking about different marketing approaches. Then hopefully you get them to activate and then try to retain them. And then he's saying get them to refer others and then look at the revenue model.
Right.
So it seems like for an individual customer, it's probably going to be sequential. But for your business, in terms of what you should focus on, you may start with number three and four, like you said.
Right. And again, because these are associated with marketing, not necessarily the product, you have to remember that because number five comes in as revenue, that essentially ends the marketing pipeline, because you've already marketed to them enough such that by the time they get to the revenue phase, you are asking them for money or you have monetized them in some way, shape, or form through either ads or lead gen or something else. So the first one is acquisition. And acquisition is essentially when users come to your website, and they can come to your website from a number of different channels. They can come in through any SEO you've done, PR campaigns, social networks, direct telemarketing, TV, ads, etc. And this is essentially where you start measuring from. And this is 100%. All of the people who come to your website, all the people you get in touch with, that's where you start counting from. And that is your 100% that you should start counting from.
Right. So this is the top of the funnel, right? This is all of your marketing approaches, all the high level stuff. And certainly acquisition is probably talked about more than a lot of his other points, than the other 5 points, because the acquisition, the marketing approaches tend to be just the things where you can have little tips and tricks that work and can drive. It just sounds so cool to say, oh, I can drive 10,000 people to my website doing this, or 20,000 people by getting on Dig or Hacker News or some other, you know, social news thing.
Right. And that's one of those things that if you look at that and you look at those raw numbers, oh, I got 1 million people to my website. That's great and all, but how many of them activate? How many come back? How many are going to follow through and do any of your calls to action? And getting 1 million people to your website is great, but if you're not doing these other things to essentially follow up with them, then it really doesn't matter.
He's just saying it's almost like visitor acquisition. It's not actually acquiring the customer. It's just getting someone to come to your website And step two then is activation.
Correct. So activation is when users enjoy their first visit. If they have some sort of a happy user experience, if they hit your homepage or a landing page, or they stay for more than a couple of seconds, because a lot of people will come to your website and just at a glance, they say, no, this isn't what I want, and they hit the back button. Or if they start clicking around your website a little bit, if they view two or three pages or four, those are the people that you want to start tracking. Again, you're moving from that, you know, 100% people who are in the acquisition stage down to maybe you get 25% of them or 50% of them into the activation stage. And as you start measuring these, obviously that funnel is going to whittle people down, but you want to get as many people down to the revenue stage as you possibly can. But again, this is just your marketing funnel.
Yeah, I think the way I would think about activation in terms of maybe a SaaS app or, you know, WordPress plugin or some type of software product, I would think that activation would either be someone who signs up for a trial, or better yet, is someone who signs up to hear more about the knowledge that you're spreading, basically through a like an email follow-up sequence, something the similar thing that I'm trying to do with Drip that we do with Hittail and I do in, with all my products. I think that getting a certain percentage of people to engage, to give you permission to contact them again, is likely a good indication of activation. Can you think of others aside from them entering an email in a box? But it seems like a trial or them giving you an email is activation. Do you see other options for that?
Well, that's not really what Dave is talking about when he's talking about activation. In terms of just marketing, because what you're talking about with users activating a subscription or signing up for a newsletter or something like that, that is more about users coming back. That's about retention. What he's talking about with the second phase, which is activation, is that they actually enjoy coming to your site and they stay there. If they view a couple of pages, maybe they look at the newsletter sign-up screen. That's essentially still looking at them in terms of being in the activation stage in your marketing. If they sign up for it, then they've entered into stage three, which is the retention. But if they sign up for a trial, they've skipped all the way to the end, and you know you're trying to get them into that stage five, which is revenue.
But a trial is not revenue, right? A trial is more. I could see a trial being retention, like you're saying, mm-hmm. step three. But a trial is not revenue yet, because a whole chunk of those people will never give you a penny.
Right, but in terms of the retention that Dave is talking about, he's talking about mindshare more or less, and it's getting people to come to your site and to think about you in the future. And in terms of retention, users come back to your site. It doesn't matter if they've signed up for anything. If they come back to read your website again, because if you look at the number of people who just come to your website once and then leave and never come back, then it's an awful number to look at. I mean, people don't want to see that number, but it's really, really high. If they come back to your website for anything, whether it's because they signed up for something, or if they start viewing other pages on your website because there's a blog or additional content that they want to read, that's what he's talking about in terms of retention. It's not about retaining you as a potential customer for a product. It's about retaining some sort of a mind share for you to want to come back.
I hear what you're saying. I think that could be done using, let's say you have a free trial of a SaaS app, or you have a free version of a WordPress plugin. That is what's going to bring them back to your site, right? Mm-hmm. Or if they sign up for a 5-day email course, that's what I'm thinking of in terms of the step three retention. Would you agree with that stuff or not?
No, I do. Okay. It's just that I guess morphing what you were talking about in terms of activation. Because
okay.
you had said activation, they sign up for a trial. I'm like, well, that's
jumping
not
jumping the gun.
Yes, that's jumping all the way to step five. It's not. Not quite the same thing.
So activation then, which is step two, is you think it's pre them giving you anything. It's just them having a good experience on your site rather than them actually giving you an email or taking any kind of action.
Correct.
Got it.
And then step three, as you said, they sign up for a mailing list, or they sign up for a newsletter, they start reading the blog, they come back to it, and you know, they start actively looking for a little bit more information.
You know, I imagine, Mike, someone might be listening to us and thinking, how can they improve step two, the activation stage? Because I think we talk a lot about acquisition and retention, but how do you make someone have a better first visit, have a better happy user experience?
Well, you have to kind of walk them through what you expect them to do or what you expect them to understand from your website. You want to strip it down. You want to make sure that there's as little information there as possible that is distracting. And that's one of those things where you look at a landing page, and a lot of landing pages these days, they only have one or two links on them. They look like the rest of your site, but almost nothing is clickable. And they may rip out some of the navigation. They may rip out a lot of the additional images that are on the page. And all of that's in an effort to minimize what the user has to pay attention to. So if there's only two buttons on the screen, and obviously those are your only two options to click on anything, if you've arrived there from either a Twitter campaign or from Google AdWords or something like that, if it's a true landing page and those are your only two options, you really make it simple for the person. Either they use the back button and they leave entirely, or they move forward on one of those two options. They don't really get around to the rest of your site. And you can help drive them to do exactly what it is that you want them to do, such as signing up for a mailing list or watching a quick video or signing up for the newsletter, things like that.
Yeah, I think there's a couple really common mistakes made at this point, like with landing pages. The first one I see over and over is giving way too much information. You should give the minimum amount of information, and you should and need to be able to communicate your product's value proposition to that specific audience and realize that that value proposition may be different for different audiences you're marketing to, but you should send each of those to a different landing page then. But you should be able to communicate your value prop to that audience in one sentence or even shorter than that, like six words, an incomplete sentence. And if you can't do that, then your product is too complicated. And you need to figure out what the single most valuable value prop that someone's going to be coming through that click to find. You know, that's what you're trying to do. You can't have 10 value props on the page thinking that you're going to capture everyone, because you're basically going to capture no one, right? The second error that I see is doing the opposite of what you said, which is putting a lot of links, giving people, you know, all the paths through your website. And I think that the natural inclination is to think, oh, well, you know, if they don't want to give me their email, then I don't want to chase them off. I don't want to lose those people. And the fact is, if they don't want to give you their email, then they aren't a good prospect. They aren't interested enough in your product to type in their email and trust your, you know, your website hasn't built enough trust to convince them that you're not going to spam them and that you're actually going to provide them with something valuable. If they're not going to do that, then either number one, your offer is bad and you need to fix it, or number two, they're just not a good fit for you and you're wasting your time marketing to them anyways.
So stage three in this process is retention. And like you said, getting people to sign up for a newsletter or email list, walking them through a tutorial, things like that, making sure that you have planted enough mindshare such that they will come back to your website. Those are the things that you're really looking for when it comes to retention.
Yeah, and retention can happen in a number of ways. You know, if you think 5 or 10 years ago, retention was just someone came to your website and then remembered to come back to your website. And that's a really poor way to play it these days. There's much better tools for it. You know, before social media and blogging and all the email lists and all that stuff, that was what most people did. And if you actually go into your analytics and you look at the number of the percentage of people who purchase that are first-time visitors versus returning visitors, it's typically anywhere between 2 and 10 times more returning visitors purchase from you. And I looked at this in my business software talk a couple years ago, and I talked to Heaton Shaw about it for Crazy Egg. I think Patrick McKenzie, I had numbers from him. I had numbers from Dave Rodenbaugh from a number of my apps, and they across the board, it was a minimum of 200% improvement for returning visitors. And like I said, I think with Crazy Egg, it was like 14 times more people purchased who were returning visitors. And so you can always rely on people remembering, but that's a really, really bad way to do it. You want to improve your odds of having them come back by doing things we talk about a lot on the podcast. And it's, you know, offering a 5-day email course, some type of reward so they sign up for your email list so you can ping them every once in a while. It is maybe having Facebook and Twitter and having them follow you, but those are just such weak ties these days that it's not something I really go after. I always go after the higher commitment approach, like an email or a trial. I mean, when someone's actually trying your app, then you have even more of an excuse to get in touch with them and to answer their questions via email. And I think those are probably the top ways these days that I'd recommend looking at retention. And this is actually, I mean, as a little plug, like that's why I'm building Drip. It's at getdrip.com. It helps with this step. It helps you retain more and be able to contact them more and work them, you know, turn them into trial users and or customers.
Right. And all that's a more focused on actively trying to retain them versus passively just hoping that they will come back to your website, or that you've provided enough information on your website to begin with that they come back on their own. Something else that I think we haven't really mentioned yet about retention that I think would fall into this is if you're using Google or AdRoll or any of these other services that will market to them after they have left your website and essentially follow them around with advertisements when they visit other websites.
That's exactly right. Retargeting or remarketing, as it's called. Yep. And you can do it both on other websites they visit, or even now Facebook has remarketing. So if someone visits your website, you can remarket to them on Facebook. And that definitely works well.
The next two, number 4 and 5, are referral and revenue. And I think that these can be interchanged a little bit. It depends on the type of company that you're putting together, or the type of product that you're marketing, as to whether or not referral comes before revenue or vice versa. But with referral, users like your product enough to refer other people, and you can get them to help refer other people either through email campaigns or things on your that you do on your website, contests, having widgets on your website that they can either download onto their desktop or onto their website. There's a number of different ways that you can allow people to refer other people to your product or service.
There's a whole world that goes on in this viral marketing type stuff where, if you've ever heard the term viral coefficient, you're shooting for as high a viral coefficient as possible. And that means that every new user you get refers X other users. There's a certain number when you're at a one viral coefficient, it means that every new user refers one other user. And a certain number that you hit that I think like Sean Ellis talks about, which is when you've really hit product market fit and your viral marketing is doing well. Because imagine, let's say every new user you got referred 3 other users. That's an incredible viral growth. So all you got to do is just stuff as many new visitors into the top of the funnel, and then business is going to multiply. That is only achievable, again, from what I've read, because I've never built a viral business like that, but it's only achievable if the virality is baked into your business. It's not something where you have them sign up for a trial of a SaaS app, and then there's a screen that says, email your friends, or refer your friends to, you know, to get a discount or something. It just, your viral coefficient will never get above 1, or very unlikely to get above 1 if it's not baked in the product. In terms of something like LinkedIn or Facebook or Twitter, where you're actually actively encouraged and that the product actually gets better the more people you refer, right? In order to use the product well, you need to refer a bunch of people. And so there's a difference here, and it's something to keep in mind. Forcing virality on a product is not necessarily a bad thing, but you can't expect it to dramatically grow a SaaS app or a WordPress plugin or just a standard software business like it would a social network or, you know, even eBay, that kind of thing, because they're different beasts. And so while virality can work in all the cases, it's something to keep in mind as you're building your business to know what kind of business you actually run and how you can use referrals and thus the virality. There's several companies that offer this now, but if you are a software type company or you're selling something, even if you're selling information, there's services like Ambassador there at getambassador.com, and I think Referrally is another one, but they basically help engineer this so you don't have to build all the engines to do this. It's kind of like having an affiliate program, someone who handles your affiliate stuff, but they offer more abilities. They offer the form, the email your friend forms, the widgets, and that kind of stuff. And I do actually use that with Hittail. That's a good way to think about doing it instead of building it yourself.
And the third R in Dave McClure's list is revenue. And in this stage, users conduct some sort of monetization behavior. And whether that is they're clicking on ads or they're filling out information that you're going to follow up on with them, for example, lead generation, if they're signing up for a subscription or doing anything that is essentially going to generate money for you, that's the revenue stage.
Like Mike said earlier, the revenue stage can come before the referral stage. But in the typical Silicon Valley startup and the stuff that Dave McClure is talking about, that referral stage, they try to put it before any type of revenue because that's how you get that viral coefficient as high as possible. Whereas building smaller businesses where, you know, you are more dependent on the revenue in order to grow it since you're bootstrapping, I would tend to put the revenue before the referral. You also need someone to be using it and be happy with it and willing to pay for it, in my opinion, before they're going to refer someone to a quote-unquote more boring business like the businesses that we do talk about on this podcast.
One of Dave's points about the referral is that your customer satisfaction for them has to be greater than an 8 for it to work anyway. If they're not particularly satisfied with the experience that they've had with your website or with your product, it's just not going to work. It's at least an 8 out of 10. Well, that kind of makes sense. I mean, if people aren't happy with it, they're not going to refer others. And if you're depending on that referral piece of it to help drive your growth, it's just not going to work.
Yeah, I think in terms of this step, the revenue step, this is harder than it sounds. I actually run into quite a few entrepreneurs who do build that application or build that software product, and they do get visitors to the website, meaning they get past the acquisition stage, and they do get some kind of activation because people at least mill around on their website, and they do get them to sign up for a trial, so some type of retention. But then they either have a free plan and the person never converts to revenue, or the trial expires and no one's converting to revenue. So getting to this fifth stage with at least 1 or 2% of your overall website visitors is harder than it sounds. And it's something that requires that you're solving a problem people have, problem solution fit, and that you're marketing to the right people so that you have product market fit. And once you hit this and you can push a lot of the folks who are in step one all the way down through the funnel and actually get some revenue from at least a small portion of them, that is when it's time to scale the business. And that's where it actually does make sense to sometimes to raise funding. I think a lot of folks take for granted, and I think I did in the early days as well, take for granted that getting to revenue is just the natural next step. It's like going to high school and then going to college and then, you know, taking the next step in that whole path. But it's not. It's actually a lot harder. The first three steps, acquisition, activation, and retention, aren't actually that hard. Getting someone to sign up for a freemium plan or getting them to sign up for a trial is really not that big of a deal. Getting someone to refer someone or getting someone to pay you money is a lot harder. And turning that into a repeatable process is even harder. But once you do, you're basically minting money. I mean, that's where you just put money in one, you put a dollar in one side and you crank the handle and then $3 comes out the other side a month or two later.
One of the other interesting things that I think Dave does with this is that he assigns an estimated value to people who are in each stage of this funnel. So at the acquisition stage, you have a lot more people, but their estimated value for each one is, you know, maybe 5 cents versus somebody who's down at the retention area because they've come back to your website a couple of times. They might be worth an estimated value of about a dollar. And then if you get down to the part where they are entering the revenue stage, they may be worth $50. And granted, these numbers can be wildly different based on what your revenue model is, how much your product costs, what your expected lifetime value is, those kinds of things. But from Dave's point of view, the interesting thing is trying to estimate the value of each of those people, because then you can essentially extrapolate how much money you should be investing into each of those phases.
That's a really good point. I actually wish I had brought that up. I have all of my funnels spelled out just like you've said. I know the exact dollar amount, and sometimes it's the cents amount for all those chains of the funnel. And I know how much I can pay to acquire a trial, how much I can pay to acquire an email address into our 5-day email sequence. I know how much we can pay to get someone on the 7-day long tail SEO crash course on Hittail. I know how much we can pay for, in general, for website visitors, although that one tends to vary, right? Because the source really matters a lot. But if you don't know those numbers, then you have a couple issues. First thing is you'll never be able to do paid acquisition. And while that's not the end of the world, paid acquisition is such a large, it's a large market that you could be reaching into that you won't be able to grow very fast, you know, without knowing these numbers. You can do things like content marketing and put out infographics and blog posts and do a lot of, you know, viral videos and be on Twitter and Facebook and do all that. And that's okay. You can drive traffic fairly inexpensively, but you still have to monetize your time. And infographics, they are fairly expensive to get designed, and they will often take a lot of your time to manage and to figure out the numbers. So in my opinion, you have to monetize those as well. The entrepreneurs I know who are doing content marketing, they won't say, oh, an infographic is free. They will look and say, all right, I'm paying a designer X $100, and I'm spending X hours of my time that are valued at $100 or $200 a piece, and I add that up. And unless this infographic or this blog post or this, you know, story that I'm trying to get placed on a guest post somewhere, unless that drives X number of trials or X number of emails, then I have a negative ROI. Even though I didn't actually output that money, I output it in time. And so I truly believe in basically monetizing and quantifying all elements. Even if you're not cash out of your pocket, it's really important that you know your numbers. that, in my opinion, is the way that you're going to be able to monitor things and to go after the things that work and double and triple down on them, actually grow your business the fastest.
So just to recap that, the first stage is acquisition, which is users coming to your website from various channels. The second one is activation, and that's where people enjoy their first visit. They have some sort of a happy user experience. Third one is retention. Users come back to your site, visit it multiple times. Fourth one is referral. And again, the fifth one is revenue, which can be interchanged with referral. But referral is people like your product enough to refer others. And the fifth one is revenue, in which users conduct some sort of monetization behavior.
If you have a question for us, you can call it into our voicemail number at 888-801-9690 or email us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Startups or by RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com, where you'll also find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. See you next time.